My guilty pleasure. I adore luxury, but I bloody love a good fake.
Oh, I'm shooketh, shooketh. I think we have to defriend you now, Sherway. That is horrible, horrible.
Welcome to Back of Napkin, the podcast created in honor of that great tradition of big ideas doodled on little pieces of paper, where we here at Fleischmann Hillard are passing a napkin to top marketing leaders who will sketch out what's on their minds about the topics that are on ours.
Hello, I'm your host, Candace Peterson, Global MD of Brand Marketing at Fleischmann Hillard. But what with London Fashion Week having just wrapped earlier this week, I suppose cheers is a more appropriate greeting for this episode. It's also the perfect time to ask our very own Shira Hager, our brand luxe lead from across the pond in London, to take a pulse on what's next for luxury brands. Shira is joined by the head of culture and entertainment for Diageo Europe, Nioma Ulu, luxury brand micro-influencer Hans Tronberg, and Andre Bogues, our resident youth and culture expert. Together, they indulge us in an altogether posh discussion around the interesting tensions luxe brands are facing as a whole. So enjoy.
We're here today to talk about luxury. Where's it come from? Where's it going? Has it lost its way? And drum roll, please, is luxury even relevant? Nioma and Hans in particular have huge experience and appreciation of the luxury sector, from rich storytelling to craft and heritage. We have talked relentlessly about luxe and what it means to us. But in like sort of a few words, Nioma, we'd love to get your thoughts on this. Can you let me know what you think luxury is to you?
So it's really interesting because when you approached me for this, I was like, okay, well, what does luxury mean today? And what does it mean to me? And I think my sort of work hat versus my personal hat luxury, both, of course, are very, very different. I would say luxury brands today, we talk a lot about being culturally relevant. It's really, really important that, you know, that it's not about kind of cost and price, but about kind of quality and value. And the nuances in those words are very poignant, I think, in terms of really demonstrating what luxury means today. And also the kind of motivation to buy, therefore, how a brand connects with the consumer.
Yeah, I think also from my point of view, what I think is interesting is I think it's become a lot more of a democracy when it comes to luxury. I think which has a lot to do with social media and having people being exposed to luxury way more than we did 10 years ago or 20 years ago. Where I think it used to be almost a bit of a private members club. It was a bit closed off. Whereas I think now everyone kind of is a bit more involved and everyone kind of really wants to buy luxury or have kind of a piece of luxury. So whether that's down to buying a phone case or buying, a $30,000 fur coat, I think everyone's kind of... well, if it's Gucci, it's faux these days. But I think like now it's really like everyone's kind of taking part of it because luxury is so different from each individual, from what Nioma wants, what I want. I mean, we kind of want the same thing, to be honest. But I think looking at some of the other people we work with or know that they want something completely different to me.
I think that's really, really interesting because I know that whenever we're talking about luxury, especially with us having to now create like an almost new work stream or specialism because we're seeing loads of people wanting to have people just have expertise or an interest in it. We wouldn't have probably have thought about like even specializing or talking about it 10 years ago. And I think we're all kind of using similar words and we're seeing this broadening of audiences. And you talk about culture, Nioma, especially in the work that you do. But why do you think luxury has had to change? Did you have any thoughts, Andre?
I think it's going back to becoming something a lot more personal. Working in luxury retail for like a few years, like you kind of see that everyone approaches it in a different way. And I think there are more audiences and it's more accessible. So people kind of brands have to kind of approach consumers in a really different way. And I kind of think generational changes as well. So you've got like Gen Z who are kind of coming up seeing luxury as something super different. Like, whereas 10 years ago, you know, Louis Vuitton was super luxury. Now it's Supreme and Supreme's entering the kind of Louis Vuitton space and it's all becoming it's just changing a lot. And I think it's had to change because you've got a bit more of a for us, by us kind of rebellious side coming through consumers. Like, everyone can do things now. Like, you can create your own store, you can create your own magazines. So luxury kind of has to bounce back and realize that people can do the same things that luxury brands can.
I was going to say, sort of building on that, that I think that, you know, one of the massive catalysts for change in the luxury industry was social media. Yeah. Because actually, when you really think about fashion, when you think about luxury brands, a lot of the brands that you would kind of name call are fashion brands.
Yeah.
And as soon as you started having sort of, you know, social media influencers, Twitter, Instagram, Snapchat, you name it, Foursquare, who remembers that? You know, people really, you know, it transforms the access. So before, you'd have to wait for 6 months before you saw what the collections were, and that you were doing in kind of static print publications. But then it was transformed to, you know, instantaneous, sitting front row, you know, live streaming to what it is now, which is, you know, as you say, is very much kind of like you can buy from the catwalk. And actually, fashion brands, and this is why Hans and I kind of, you know, really delight in luxury and conversations about this, is because we both have this kind of passion for fashion, but also really, you know, seeing that fashion brands really set the trends for the wider luxury category.
Yeah.
So I think that using that kind of lens has been really, really interesting and has forced other brands to really adapt.
Yeah, I think also just like brands are really listening to all these voices that have come through via social media. And I think especially when it comes to diversity in the sense of what customers want and who are the customers, I think if you rewind 10, 20, again, 30 longer years back, people used to think that it was almost a bit of an elitist white kind of community where all the customers were rich white women or rich white men. And actually, that's not the case whatsoever. But all of these voices weren't heard or seen. But I think thanks to social media, all of these new spikes of cool and interesting customers have come through. And I think the brands have really paid attention to that. And it's been a huge shift of what we've seen is going on, not just from a retail perspective and product perspective, but also how campaigns are developed and how shows are being cast, and also how even talent are being hired for the big fashion houses as well.
Yeah, and I think that's a really, for us, I think especially in the room, it's a really beautiful point, like the topic of diversity. And you've mentioned across the board that we're seeing better representation on in the luxury industry to help appeal to new audiences, but also to really represent what's really out there in the real world. So Edward on Vogue, who we cannot not mention, like, that man is a genius and a god and an icon. Dan for Gucci and Virgil at Louis Vuitton. We seem to be a really long way, if we're going to be really honest, from where we need to be. Notions of beauty remain overtly the same. The power of balance of power remains really, honestly, with a privileged few. So the question I wanted to ask, Hans, is will luxury ever look like the outside world, and should it?
I think one of the interesting things is a lot of people are questioning if this diversity and all the kind of changes we're seeing at a lot of big fashion houses, you know, people are asking, is that just going to be a trend? Is that just going to be now, are the designers going to, you know, have the upkeep of continuously casting models of different ethnicities and backgrounds? And I think so, yeah, because I think because of the backlash a lot of people have seen and a lot of the criticism that people have seen, I think not only are brands doing it because they hear people telling them, but I also think a lot of people have been educated a bit more. I think we've learned via social media and via current media and publications of what's actually happening and really understanding other people who aren't as privileged as some are. And I think it's really molding and shaping it. And I think luxury will see a huge boom in terms of the brands and the countries where they come from and who's behind them. And I also think it will open up opportunities for us to be exposed to both designers and brands from South America, from Africa, more from Asia. I mean, I know South Korea and Japan are having great moments, but I think we're going to see a lot more from China and even from some countries like Mongolia or Taiwan, for instance, that all of a sudden will kind of skyrocket and be very interesting. You never know, even North Korea might jump on the wagon, you know?
No comment.
We all work for, well, have done, Neoma. We work in this room, there's three of out of four of us that work for an agency with our main task of like guiding brands that become more relevant. You actually work for Diageo, you're on client side. But we all have like this role to really help brands become more relevant. And we appear to have a generation that feels more engaged than ever, from politics to like environmental issues to the question of identity. And obviously we understand that brands need to sort of react to that and also come at it in a very authentic way. Are there any brands that you think are really nailing it at the moment where it doesn't feel like it's a flash in the pan? They are actually doing things that feel authentic. Or does it even matter? Just the fact that they're doing something, is it a good thing? Andre?
I feel like a brand, like you mentioned Virgil at Louis Vuitton, I think that's a brand that is kind of helping to push things forward a bit, because you've got someone who had like no formal training that's kind of broken into the circle of like, you know, these designers that just rotate between the different fashion houses. And I think Louis Vuitton have seen, even like collaborating with Supreme, that there's a way to work with people outside of that circle. And it's still, I mean, it probably brought in more money than it ever has before.
I think a really interesting campaign for me, and I don't know whether this would be classed as a luxury brand, but I think that's for another podcast, is the makeup brand face and makeup brand, beauty brand, Glossier.
Oh, yeah.
Because I think that, you know, in terms of, you know, first of all, it's a brand that has always been customer and consumer first. So it was started from, you know, being effectively a blog, and, you know, really getting under the skin of what consumers want, the feedback model in terms of kind of commenting on, you know, brands once they tried it, and then kind of using all of that intel to develop products that they understood that their consumer wanted, but then also using that platform of super engaged consumers and customers to then champion diversity in a way that I think in beauty brands has never really been seen before. Not just from color, because of course I think when we talk about diversity and inclusion, that's a lot of what springs to mind for people in the first instance, but also about size. And actually for a beauty brand that is, you know, talking about kind of cleansers and makeup, to have plus size models who are completely nude on massive billboards across America, for me is, you know, a sign of things to come. And also the fact that, you know, are we going to see Louis Vuitton or Gucci take the same route? I don't think so. But when these subcultures are so important to kind of influencing the masses and showing that actually it can be done. And when it's done well, you know, it feels right and it's good and it's people feel connected. So I think that there can only be more, but I know with my sort of, you know, client side hat, that there are so many restrictions when you're client side. And you can only look at examples like a Kendall Jenner and Pepsi to see that some of the other examples that, you know, I won't even call, but to see that sometimes bigger brands get it really wrong. And therefore, when a big brand gets it wrong, it really does make everyone recoil and pull back. So it's very difficult to then move forward. So I think that there will always be that tension of the smaller, nimble brands being able to do more and the larger brands wanting to do more, testing the water and then recoiling. So, but I think, you know, net-net will get there, but it's definitely challenging.
I think also, it makes me realise that like every time we work in PR, there's this kind of like, oh yeah, it's like feels really fluffy. But it feels like now, like for the first time ever, there's a real chance that we get to like change people's opinions or help people. Yeah. Like we can actually make change happen in luxury space, whether it's fashion or beauty. It doesn't have to be like a worthy CSR campaign. It's rooted in something. And that's the beauty, I think, of where we're at with comms and what we do at the moment.
I think also from my point of view, I think the bullshit factor, I could talk a lot about bullshit factor.
Yeah.
And I think in general, the bullshit factor with the general consumer and the public is so low these days. Like we see through things immediately now.
Yeah.
And I actually think that people want real campaigns. They want to feel something. And I think we used to talk about authenticity and, you know, mm-hmm. how we would gather news and learn about products or wanting to buy things. And that kind of moved on to Authenticity 2.0, where we used to have influencers who were kind of, you know, being part of campaigns because they were real people like us and we could connect with them. And then that's kind of started to crack a bit over the years because all of a sudden they're getting paid for things that they don't really care about, which is problematic. And I think that's now again gone to like Authenticity 3.0, where we want hyper real. Like we want to see stretch marks, not all the time, but we like still appreciate that they are there. We want to see a variety in models in shapes and sizes and diversity because that's how the real world is.
I think going on your point about authenticity, it would be really prudent of me not to mention the amazing campaign by Nike and by Colin Kaepernick, which we have been desperate to talk about because this was this man 2 years ago that was reprimanded for bending the knee. And now he's now the face of Nike. What, a week ago, people were burning Nike shoes. But what's happened is now it's 31% uplift in sales in like the space of what was it, Andre? Like a week and a half?
3 days.
So people are, we know that consumers are buying principle over product or logo. It'd be really good to like understand like your thoughts on the campaign, like the Nike campaign. Why do you think that that has really resonated with a huge amount of audience, not just in the US but in the UK, and like how that campaign has really captured hearts and minds?
What Hans talks about in terms of the bullshit factor is really important on this one. Is, you know, we are done with the kind of glossy version of life, and also in a time when we have fake news, lots of political things that we kind of don't really want to talk about, Brexit, Trump, etc. You know, people, you know, as you say, Sherrod, kind of stand for something and their values. And they are very happy to use their pounds and dollars to reflect that. And so I think as a brand like Nike, who can do something like this, because, you know, of course, it's one of those things that you see in marketing week and you're just like, oh gosh, probably there is like 0.5% of brands in the whole world could do anything like this.
Yeah.
But a brand like Nike is, you know, we know what it stands for, and we know what it means to people. And so I think that the fact that they have done this says so much about their brand. But also, you know, this is someone who still has not got a team, you know, and is fronting a Nike campaign and, you know, selling so much. And you know, it kind of shows that people and values transcend products and brands, and they will outlive, we will outlive those brands. It won't be the brands outliving us. So I think that that's a really poignant point for brands to take from it. And I think, you know, that sort of similarly linked to, you know, something that we've talked about really passionately, Shara, the kind of US Open final with Serena Williams, I think, you know, again, is, you know, I know that this is a discussion about luxury, but, you know, we quickly move to diversity. And I think that the two are kind of intertwined, and it's not about race all the time. I mean, it can be sometimes.
Yeah.
But, you know, the fact that, you know, a man and a woman can do the same job and have the same reaction and get, you know, responded to in completely different ways. I think in 2018, for all the great things that we talk about in terms of, you know, Fenty Beauty, Savage Fenty, you know, just this kind of last couple of days having plus size models and pregnant models walking down the runway, we still have someone who is literally the greatest athlete of all time.
Yeah.
One of, you know, having to go through what she went through and on such a public stage, but still being gracious. I think that values count for so much.
Yeah.
And the brands that will survive are the ones that have strong values and can really connect with their consumers.
Yeah. And again, just going back to a bit why I said about Authenticity 3.0, we want the hyper real. Like, I think the fact that people that really stand for something or aren't afraid to being themselves 100% and even going against the stream is really applauded these days, as long as you don't go against the stream and doing something really badly.
Yeah.
You know, not being like Jersey Shore. But, you know, I think it's just really, like, again, a different example, but I think why Cardi B has been such a hit is, you know, it's a combination of, obviously, she's a great rapper, rapper and she's doing great music, but she's hyper real and people really connect with the fact that she's not media trained. She laughs, she has her tongue out, she's being really silly, she answers questions in a cartoon voice. And I think it's again that, like, it's a huge contrast to that Nike campaign, but it's again so different and it's so real that we really appreciate it. It's like, it's not pretentious, it's actually really stripped back and someone just being like having a good time and being themselves. And yeah. I think in these dire times people look to that and look to that authenticity and someone really standing for something. It might be political, it might be serious, but it can also be humorous and happy.
And it's interesting that there is no product in that visual. You know, I think that that also says so much for brands who are scared to deviate from product and be very product first in kind of in everything that they do in comms, whether that's kind of advertising, PR and other channels.
I'm very glad we talked about Serena. I'm going to talk about quickly about culture. And we all know it just seems to be like this thing everyone's banging on about. And like, I have to be honest, I'm a bit like, culture, like, I was trying to explain to my husband, and I think it was one of the questions that you had texted me on, and he was like, what are you talking about, culture? Like, you lot seem to just talk about these random things and have these really random bingo words and no one else understands unless we seem to work in the industry. And it kind of made me think about it a little bit more. Like, we all understand that culture has become this holy sort of mech or the holy grail. And it's even in Neoma's official work title, which
I
is
love.
Hilarious. Like, head of culture, everything has to be through
I
you.
I feel like every booth job comes with a culture thrown in the title. But I'm jealous. Culture. I want that as well.
Yeah. Culture.
The reason why I think it's a bit of a red herring is because culture, like, if we were to get out the Oxford Dictionary and look at the word culture, we'd be looking at arts, crafts and museums, basically, because that's what the definition is. So I think that when you, and, you know, I have to kind of defend this because it's in my title, as you rightly pointed out. And I think that, you know, we kind of can get caught up in what culture really means, and also culture plus lux. And I think from my perspective and in what I do, which is really kind of starting with product and brand, that people, you know, I work in the drinks industry. When you go to a bar, typically you say that you want a vodka and soda, or you want the best tasting cocktail on the menu. So inherently, my job is very challenging because you consumers make it so, because you basically are not brand loyal. So we've been talking for I'm not sure how long now, but we've been name checking beauty brands, fashion brands, brands that we care about, that we have an affinity to or affinity with. But drinks brands tend to not be like that. And this is where cultural relevance comes in, rather than what I would argue is the short form is culture. And, you know, what we need to do with our brands, and there are other brands that face this as well, is ensuring that we connect with our consumers using their passion points that goes beyond our product, so that they can see why this product and brand would have a role in their lives and why they should kind of choose that product. So in terms of like what I do, it is really much around starting culture first, but really what that kind of means is consumer first. Like, what does our consumer care about? Is it about Serena Williams? Is it about Colin Kaepernick? Like, is it about kind of sustainability? Or is it just about wanting to own or taste or experience beautiful things? It could be all of the above. We are so multifaceted as human beings these days. So, you know, trying to kind of navigate through that and find the right things, it is really kind of basically the heart of it. And I think that to that end, and again, this is another sort of area that Hans and I are very passionate about, is partnerships when it comes to brands. Because often, you know, you cannot sell the dream by yourself. You tend to need to partner and share in that dream with another like-minded brand. You know, thinking about kind of Louis Vuitton and Supreme, for example, thinking about in the drinks industry, we do lots of collaborations, whether that's kind of bars, whether that's designers, whether that's, you know, working in music or in arts and fashion. And it's really, really important for us to be able to do that, so that we can stand for something more than just what you drink in the glass.
Yeah.
I also think, from my point of view, the cultural relevance and what Neoma said about being multifaceted, I think one of the challenges that you have is just like, now we move on so fast and we're not loyal as consumers anymore. And I also like to say that, you know, I think again, I love going back into years in this podcast, but like 10 and 20 years ago, you'd be like, I'm a PR professional, or I'm a banker, or I am a nanny. You'd have these like titles. Whereas I think now we've kind of evolved and we see ourselves as what I like to call as slashies. So you maybe say you're a PR professional, but you might be a florist, slash you might be a, I don't know, a cartoonist, slash you might be a comedian. So like you have all these different things that you do. I mean, look at people's Instagram profiles these days. Like you see when people says like have they have their name, and then they'll put all these little things that they actually do or have. So like you're so much more than, you know, like you might be a housewife, but you also might be like, I don't know, the British master knitting, I don't know, but all these kind of things, all these elements. And I think people are harder to kind of get through to and satisfy because we are more well-rounded, we're more interested in different things, and we also jump from thing to thing and trend to trend and app to app because of the digital world that we live in. So I think like Neoma has such a, I mean, and I have such a challenger job as well. Not about you.
Here we go.
But I think as a creative, one of the challenges that I have, and similar to what Neoma has in her job, is like we constantly need to have the our finger on the pulse and what's happening and really understand how the world and our environment and culture, which whatever culture means, is moving about, and how we can kind of like insert ourselves into that and kind of work with our surroundings to make it like interesting and appealing to people. And that's quite challenging. I think our jobs were a lot easier 10 years ago than they are now.
But I think culture, like to me, is like it's a collective consciousness. It's like everyone thinking in the same way kind of thing. And that's, you've got brands like Topshop and like Nike who can reflect that because the production time and what they do is so quick. But I think to me, culture as the bigger sense of the word, like a small C culture in like the UK, is separate to luxury. I actually don't think luxury really touches culture. I think it creates its own. You've got all these like houses and drinks brands and fashion brands that kind of have their own iconography and they kind of do their own thing. And I think anytime they kind of try to touch into culture, like Dior had the We Should All Be Feminist t-shirts, they got like ripped to filth for it because it's not culturally relevant. And selling a $500 t-shirt that says we should be feminist isn't really what people want in culture. And I think people see luxury as something separate to their day-to-day, unless you're like filthy rich. And I think that's quite interesting because I feel like there are luxury brands who are trying to encroach in the day-to-day culture, but it's so separate to what people do and what people want.
Yeah, and I think it comes with age as well, wanting to like become more invested. And I think 10 years ago we all kind of wanted to do like the photo call and just send out the press release or the product press release, and we didn't really understand the value of brand and how much brands can actually impact the world and how much more richer the campaigns can be if we just love them a bit more.
But it's also because we are just exposed to so much more these days, and things don't stick with us. And because we are in a swiping culture where we sit on devices and we constantly swipe for the next, like it's very hard for us to get invested. So we are constantly chasing the next high, so to say. But it is now it's a picture or a video.
And I think that what's really interesting about culture, and Hans, and maybe for Andre, because I know you love fashion.
Yeah.
I wanted to talk about Fashion Week and New York Fashion Week in particular, because I have been following Hans, your Insta channel, as you know, a dedicated and devoted fan. And we saw that you had a recent takeover on a couple of the magazines. I'll leave it up to you if you want to brag. And it's interesting to see how different New York Fashion Week is from European Fashion Weeks. And Neoma and I would work on a couple of the fashion weeks back in the day when we used to work for a couple of the fashion houses. And I think the European ones are always very traditional. It follows a very, very straightforward pattern. And you don't rarely see anything that's very different. But the New York one, particularly this year, maybe it's because we were following you a lot, because we love you.
Oh, thank you.
But it just felt like New York has really kind of come into its own. It's part of the circuit. It felt edgier. The models just looked different. The vibe felt different. And I'd love to get your thoughts on like what you think, or how you think Fashion Week has changed. And then Andre, like, you know, just following it from like sitting in London, how that kind of felt for you, like whether you were really inspired by it as well. But Hans, maybe we start with you first.
Yeah, sure. So I mean, so I go over every season in New York, and I do a couple of shows. I usually do Jeremy Scott, which I attend as a guest, which is very nice. And then I also help out one of my really, really good friends, Christian Cowan's show. So he is a friend that I've had for about 5 or 6 years now. And we actually worked together on a collaboration a few years ago, which was supposed to be just like a cute little UK execution. And it went mega viral. And we ended up, what was supposed to be a week's work ended up being 6 months because we got so much coverage on this thing that we did, which was ace. But what I love about Christian, and which I also think reflects in a lot of the New York shows, because he used to show here in London and then went over to New York, and this was his fourth season. And what I find with the New York shows and the fashion as well is I do think that the New Yorkers push the boundaries a lot more, and I think they're a lot more forward in many ways when it comes to presentation. The clothes you can discuss in many ways with a lot of the designers, because I think some of the designers are not as exciting as they used to be, and they're more commercial and they're more safer because of the market that they're based in, whereas I think you can take a lot more creative risks in Europe and in Asia as well. But what I love, and especially what I think Christian does so well, which I think a lot of other runways in New York does really well, is I think it's the most diverse market. I think their castings are just astonishing. They're so much better. And what surprises me is I see London as a very diverse city, but I don't think comparing the castings from London Fashion Week to New York Fashion Week, it's a different story. I think the variety of models, the sizes of models you see, it's really, really kind of having a huge kind of shift where you're now having almost, you know, I mean, the amount of girls of color in a show is massive. You know, there used to be maybe one or two, whereas in New York, if that at all, it was very true. If some of them didn't even have any, whereas I think like I saw, I mean, Christian's show had, I think it was 85% girls of color, if not even more, to be honest. And I think a lot of other designers are kind of following that in the sense of just having lots of different girls because it's more exciting. It makes the life clothes come to life in a different kind of way. But also, I just think they take more creative risks in like, what does the runway look like? Or who is in there? Do you even cast someone that isn't naturally a model? You also have trans models there, which I think is like very, you know, cool. But it's also, you know, they are getting cast because they're great models. And also they are part of our everyday lives as well. So I think in a way, a lot of the designers, besides Christian Cowan, obviously, because he's amazing, I think a lot the rest of the world can really need to pay attention to what a lot of New York does, because I think actually they, like you said, they're really up and coming. They're exciting. I think there's going to be a lot of shift there. And I also predict, this is actually one of my 2019 predictions, that I think we're going to see a shift of more European designers going to New York, because I think it's going to be a good market to show in.
And I think that brings us to a couple of the sort of final questions, which is the future of luxury. And we talk about Kenzo, we talk about H&M, and we talk about the collaborations. And I kind of also think, yeah, on one point, like when it first happened, the first collaborations anyway for H&M, I kind of was a bit confused in the sense that why would a luxury brand want to dilute its brand then go to an audience which is really mass? And yes, there's always going to be the argument that you want to reach a wider audience in the hope that as they grow, they will then start investing in the sort of higher brands. But in terms of these collaborations, do you think that luxury or the brands are in danger of diluting themselves?
So I think no. I think absolutely no. I think they're actually going to benefit from it more than ever. And I actually also think a lot of brands, it's become a part of the business module to do collaborations. Absolutely. Now, where you're making a lot of money. Very funny you point out to that first collaboration, which was H&M and Karl Lagerfeld.
Yeah.
And I remember Karl being furious afterwards because they made dresses in size XL and he was not having any of that. And that's now almost 15 years ago, if not even longer. It's a really, really long time. And I do think actually what H&M did sparked a lot of shift in the industry. And of course, a lot of brands have followed them. But then you also look at brands like, for instance, Comme des Garçons, which is one of my favorites, who their business model now is like, I mean, I would guess almost 30% is based around collaborations because they partner with so many brands and brands die to partner with them because it's good. And it's not just from a business perspective, but I also think it actually helps elevate you in getting in front of new audiences and getting people excited about you. I think, for instance, from my point of view, I built a relationship with Margiela because of the H&M collaboration, which I absolutely loved, and getting people interested and involved with it. I think it's great. And also what I talked about earlier, how, again, we're in this swiping culture. We're in this culture where we buy, buying decision time is a lot shorter. We're very fast in terms of moving on to new things. I do think we forget faster as well now. So I think if a brand does something or does a collaboration and let's say it's not successful, I think we move on from it quite quickly and it's okay. I think like we're so used to new things coming along the whole time that I think it's fine.
So Hans, this brings me a question that I've always been dying to ask you but didn't have the balls to do it.
Oh my God.
So, you know, you talk about H&M, we talk about collaboration. And Fashion Week. And there is an argument that Fashion Week in itself is a really old concept, that fast fashion is here. We, you know, you want to see something. Seasons are now really unpredictable. Like, I don't want to go into a shop and see autumn, winter. I still want to buy summer clothes. Do you think that Fashion Week still has a place?
I do. I do think so. I think this is a very interesting question because I think there's some rights and some wrongs to what you're saying. So what I think is, people have always seen Fashion Week as a really glamorous thing, but in reality, it's actually technically a trade show. If you think about it, it is a trade show for the clothing industry, for fashion industry. And what I think is Fashion Week is not going to go away, but I think the design and the layout of Fashion Week will change. So you've seen how some designers now have kind of jumped off the schedule and showing at different times. So like they're now showing their collections right before they come out, so they actually fit the season. So how, for instance, Alexander Wang showed in June now, and his like those clothes will probably go live in his shops pretty soon. To really, I think it's like shaking up how our seasons are coming along, and obviously, thanks global warming. Obviously, like now we can't wear a coat until it's freaking November. So I think like that kind of shift will happen. But I think Fashion Week will always be there. So one of the things that I saw today, which I think is super interesting, is so I don't know if you guys know, but Project Runway is coming back very soon. But Heidi Klum and Tim Gunn, who I absolutely love, have both left the show. Bear in mind that Heidi Klum came up with the idea of the show and pitched it to Bravo back in the day, then went to Lifetime. It's now back at Bravo. But Heidi is being part of a new show on Amazon, which hasn't got a name yet, but it's a new fashion reality show where what she kind of said was, I love that Project Runway kind of became a platform for designers to get promoted, but a lot of them, nothing really happened with them after, even the winners, nothing, they didn't go anywhere. So whereas now she's doing a show for Amazon where, so it's going to be on Amazon Prime, and they're going to have a reality competition where they're going to create clothes, but the winners of each episode, the clothes will actually be made available to buy on Amazon Fashion immediately after, which I was like, this is super interesting. And again, an evolution of how we see clothes. I think high fashion will always have shows and have that element because like that exclusivity will never go away. We will have some access to it with social media and stuff. But I think with fast fashion, which obviously is very dominating and having a huge presence, things like that, I think will kind of happen now where we'll get these shows or YouTubers doing things and their product will be available immediately. I think like we'll have bake-off spin-offs in the future where you can buy a recipe box right after or the shapes or stuff like that.
And so I think that brings us really quite nicely to our last question, which is if we look 10 years from now, where will the future of luxury be? And I think let's all, like, as we did start the programme or the podcast, we're going to end on, like, the same game. So in 10 years' time, the future of Lux will be, in my opinion, there will be a retail revolution. And customers and retail will have a total 360 on how we interact and how we play with how we purchase brands, and especially luxury brands in particular. Andre?
I think it'll be quite similar. I think you're still going to have brands with their like iconography and like everything, like the rituals that you do in store, like each brand's different. But I do think online will be a big change. Like Burberry just released the first like Riccardo Tischke thing, and there's like 24 hours that you can buy it and then it's gone. So I think brands will be smarter in the ways they get people to buy things online.
Yeah, I have to agree with you, Andre. I think that brands will be activating in the same way, operating in the same way, but there will be pockets of things that they are doing differently to adapt to consumer needs. So I think that we'd probably be having the same conversations. Hopefully our luxury guilty pleasures will be something far more fabulous. But I also think that luxury isn't dead and will never die, because people like to have nice things, or they like to have nice experiences. So there is always a place for luxury, but how we kind of have access to that will change. And also, I think that there may be a bit of a shift in terms of the accessibility, and I think it will be further democratized. So it might be that, you know, we're trading time for things. And I think that is exciting, and you know, really, I look forward to it and to doing this again.
I think, from my point of view, I think just looking at what Gucci, for instance, has done with having a youth panel, kind of a millennial panel that they go and talk to for advice, where, you know, they've told them, oh, don't do fur anymore because that's so bad. And also talking about having more accessible price points on certain products. I think a lot of brands will kind of engage in a lot more younger experts, and also hiring more younger talent and team to be part of the design process. So looking at, for instance, what Kim Jones has done at Dior, over hiring Yoon from Ambush, which is a really cool, you know, South Korean / Japanese brand, kind of getting these, I think getting lots of younger people in to really understand what's happening, what people really want, and creating products that are targeted towards those. Because I think, like, it's very scary having a product that's just focused on one client and one type of customer, because there are so many opportunities now, and there's such a fight for the money out there, you know. And I think overall, what I'm trying to say is, I think there's going to be a lot more different product with all of the different brands. And I think we're going to be surprised to see what they're going to be offering, and that there's going to be something, like you said, democratized. It's going to be available for everyone. Not everyone, but cheaper price points.
Guys, thank you so much. We spent the last sort of 50 minutes talking about diversity, authenticity, being true to oneself, culture, the future of luxury. I am so, so genuinely really excited that we got to do this, and just from a personal level, thank you so much for taking your time out. So thank you once again to Hans, thank you again to Neoma, and thank you to the lovely Andre for taking some time to join us on our second podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
This has been a production of Fleishman Hillard, a global public relations and marketing agency serving the world's top brands. For more information about this podcast and to listen to previous episodes, visit FleishmanHillard.com / brand-marketing.